Okay.
See you tomorrow.
I will first tell you these randoms, not random, but the not equation related things. So the first thing, important thing is, I know homework two is, the other version is posted too. Both have the first part, which is the escape room, since you have already done one, that you should know that there is a clip. This time this link even has an arrow says, I am a link, so click them. And I need you to be done by the next Monday lecture. I know the deadline is, the first deadline is next Monday night, but it would be so good if you can complete it before that next Monday lecture. Because we're going to talk about LSC in Dirac theory. It would be so good if you review the LSC in scalar theory before that. Okay, so I haven't been emphasized too much on the quizzes yet. But as you can see, all the quizzes coming up is like likely interviewed, show up in the interview. So they become more important because you are interviewed for the next five lectures, plus the tutorial, plus the quiz, plus the group activity. So please do them. Also, since you're going to be interviewed from this lecture onward, please, if you have some feedback for me, if you think I'm unclear, you should just really stop me. Otherwise, you will be spent time studying interview for something you think I'm not clear. And if you think I'm not clear, then it's because I'm not clear. So that's my logic. And I could always try to be more clear. And, okay, office hour this week is posted online. It's basically tomorrow after your tutorial and Thursday before and after the colloquium. And as it's typical, Thursday, Robert is coming to me, so I'm available until like 6. 5:50 if they are like somehow extremely fast. Okay, the last thing is a good news, so I decided to save the best for the last. Because Dan has been trying to convince me to cancel the last homework. So the last homework would turn into the last tutorial, and I'll cancel the last tutorial. And it would be up to me to put it in a way that it's doable in an hour and a half. Okay, so no more, like this is your last homework that you need to submit. Also, the last tutorial / homework happens in week 5, so I'm not going to interview you. So the next 6 lecture, next 6 lecture is what will be interviewed. And I'll tell you every lecture what you will be interviewed for. And if I see a calculation that I might want to see you in the interview do it for me, I'll tell you. If I didn't say, just assume that I wouldn't care if you can perform the calculation in the interview or not. I still wish you can do it outside the interview, but I wouldn't ask you in a stressful environment. Okay, so that's a bunch of updates. And since, okay, a joke from relativity, but this one is from Dan, I'm just telling you. So Dan has a very limited knowledge of Chinese words. Very limited. But he knows this. See? E, R, set. 1, 2, 3. Now, of course, he wondered if 1,000 is like this. No, it's not. He also knows some meat. Ro means meat. So Chinese doesn't separate the alive one and the edible one. They just add a ro, just make something edible. So now there's new row, and there is like yang row means meat. This is like lamb meat, and this is like beef meat. So he knows something. And then all of a sudden, by then I was like assisting Neil Turok to do relativity. And he all of a sudden asked me, when Ricci write down his famous tensor, what is he eating? How would I know what he was eating? And then he says, it must be R new rho, two pieces beef. So Dan writes better Chinese English fusion joke than me. I don't even know any of them. All right. Let me say again, because important things worth saying twice. You will be interviewed on this lecture. Kindly let me know if I'm not clear or in any way that you think I should change. Okay? Like everything could be interviewed, except the calculation. I never mentioned that. Calculation is one thing. All the concepts will be interviewed. And I'll tell you exactly what a calculation, I think after a course of QFT, you should be able to do even during that interview. Okay, so let's just briefly look back. What did we do last week? We started with states, and we got some creation annihilation operator, and we assembled them into a field. Okay, so that's what we did before, right? You could even say that the Weinberg's version is more like the inverse QFT. Because normally what a QFT does is start with a field and some creationalization operator shows up as promoted to be operator, and then you get a state. See, it's cool, it's a full circle. You can start from anywhere and end it back where you are. And the process of doing this is called a canonical quantization. And that's what we're going to do in the next two lectures. So today and on Wednesday, we're going to canonically quantize Dirac field. And what's important? Like throughout this week, but in particular today, is how does Dirac theory reconcile with Lorentz? So being a relativistic field theory, you always have to talk to Lorentz and accommodate. I've Googled. There's really no easy word for this thing. But let's say, why is Dirac theory is a good relativistic theory? And good means it admits the Lorentz symmetry. And even in detail, saying, I'm just trying to explain that title. The Dirac field equation should be Lorentz covariant. And then Dirac Lagrangian is Lorentz invariant. And that's what we're going to study today. Before quantize a theory, you should ask, is your theory good with Lorentz? If not, no need to quantize. Okay, so, okay, do you remember Dan's recipe? Dan has many recipes. Dan says, if I want to canonically quantize a theory, what's the step one? What's the other step? Give me some quantization steps.
Commutation relations.
Commutation relationship is definitely there. And what else did we do when we quantize?
We need classical Lagrangian equations of motion, right?
We need a classical Lagrangian. Very good. And an equation of motion, maybe. Yes, we will have it. But what kind of a Lagrangian?
Lorentz invariant.
Lorentz invariant. Okay? So today, at the end of the lecture, I'm able to point to a Lagrangian and says, this one is Lorentz invariant, and we're going to use it on Wednesday. Okay, so now we're going to derive as equation of motion pops out. That's also how Dirac write down his theory, is he starts with the equation. Okay, this is the popular way. The popular way of writing down Dirac equation is saying that you have Klein-Gordon equation, and Dirac is concerned. So what Dirac is concerned is about the density. Whatever density, I think he interpreted it as the probability density. That's why he's concerned. So I think Aldo derived the density, the current for you in Noether theorem. Lecture 14, I just checked this morning. Lecture 14, example 1.1, Klein-Gordon equation. So I'm not going to do this. Okay, I'm just going to write it out. And I'm not going to ask you to write down any, to derive with Noether theorem some density. I'm not going to. So it used to be partial mu, but we take the time component to get our density. The problem of this thing, is this is not positive definite. You can put e to the ikx, e to the minus ikx, I forgot which, but you stick it in, you find one of them is negative. So why is it a problem? If you ask Dan will be like, there's no problem. There is this plus wave, minus wave, they are all possible. What's wrong with that? But Dirac think it's a problem. It's very funny. This equation who is smarter than, I don't know, way smarter than what Dirac think the equation is, it all starts from a misunderstanding, Dirac says, that this thing needs to be positive definite. And what Dirac points out is the trouble is this derivative. And this derivative comes from the fact that there are two time derivative in the equation. So there are two time derivative in the Lagrangian. In the Noether procedure, you get rid of one, but there is still one. So that's Dirac's motivation. Let's see, Dirac has some hope for this equation. And the first hope is only one time derivative. He could be just like a mathematician says, I want to know if there is a one time derivative equation version of Klein-Gordon. But no, he says, I'll start with this wrong assumption. But he gets there. Okay. Very good. So, but remember, Lorenz, if he says my equation has one time derivative, show me a hand, how many space derivative can he have? Oh, okay, very good. How many space derivative for each dimension? In dimension x, okay, I see some hands. Yeah, right? Okay, so one spatial derivative per spatial. Otherwise, they are not treated in the equal footing that we always hope. And what else? Here's the last condition. The last condition saying that, well, there's another important thing between time and the space. What's the other important thing from relativity you learned? Relativity not only relates time to space, but also relates to energy and momentum. And that equation in our signature can be written as this. That's the four vector contract with each other. It should give mass square. What does this tells us about what kind of equation that the Dirac field needs to satisfy? Just looking like this. It's also on the board. If you put a plane wave into this other equation, you will immediately get this. There is only one equation of motion on the board. Look at here, right? If you put a plane wave there, you're going to bring down some momentum and then you get that thing. Okay, so Dirac says this new field still satisfy Klein-Gordon equation. So that's all his criteria so far. So it's very funny. So this very, very important equation comes to us as a factorization problem. So what do I mean? So Dirac says, oh, this is a square, this is b square. I can factorize a square plus b square because that's what we need to do to bring this two derivative into one. So this is his proposed way of factorization. Yeah, so the first term give you a square, the second term give you b square, cross term vanish. So yeah, it's one possible way to factorize it. If there are numbers, we don't have numbers, we decide to stick ahead anyway. So we use the right one because the right one actually acting on field. So this is because the criteria three, that he wants his field is still a solution of Klein-Gordon equation, and he used the factorization because now he wants one, just one derivative. Okay, so it turns the A and the B back to the real thing. He gets this. And he calls the field, oh, historically, everybody calls Dirac field the same name as the program psi. And at this point, you should be puzzled. Because what's wrong with this equation? I partial mu, which is A, minus B, which is M, acting on the field equals zero. Yeah? Go ahead.
It's not Lorentz covariant.
It's not Lorentz covariant, where there is a mu index. The other one doesn't. The other one is just M. Hence, Dirac says, we need some linear coefficient. To absorb that mu. And I think Dirac make the simplest assumption. These are just linear coefficients, so just numbers, one, two, and stuff. So, but now we should go back to check, because you introduced the new stuff. We should check our factorization problem. I add back the first factor, and we expect this one is the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, so let's see. So it gives partial nu, partial mu, gamma nu, gamma mu, plus m squared. Yep.
Is there any relation between that Dirac field and the other field?
The Dirac field and the Klein-Gordon field?
Yeah.
Not really, but you can probably assemble two Dirac field and call it a Klein-Gordon field. I don't think that they are necessarily. I think what I'm confusing you is basically I'm saying the Klein-Gordon field actually have a whole list of solutions. The scalar field, the scalar solution, spinner solution, the vector solution, and the three-half solution, all of them satisfy the Klein-Gordon solution. And then we're just saying in this particular case, we're looking for the Dirac solution. But it has lots of solutions. Although it's introduced as the equation of motion for scalars, but really, it says anybody satisfied this, which is everybody, would satisfy that Klein-Gordon equation. So it was kind of a misnomer call that equation the scalar equation. It's the equation for everything. Okay. So now, we just need to identify this with partial nu, partial nu. And then this will turn into a Klein-Gordon equation and I will be happy. Except whenever this happens, I'm sure now after the drill of first homework, you guys are all very familiar with this trick. If I see a factor that is symmetric, I better symmetric the other one. Like you have extracting the coefficient of omega mu nu a lot of times. And this is exactly what we do here. Okay, so the next thing I'm gonna do is write this as partial nu downstairs. That's where eta mu nu comes from. And now I can compare this one and that one. It tells me the anti-commutator of gamma nu must equal to this. And you should be like, hey, I can recognize this. I seems to be like working with this for a tutorial last week. And you'd be like, Cliff algebra shows up. It's also known as the Dirac algebra. For this specific case, Cliff algebra has lots of cases I don't know about. So it seems we're done. The Dirac equation consists of some condition on gamma and some condition on the equation of motion. So this is actually not how Dirac did it. This is people who watch Dirac did it says, oh, this is so cool. I'm going to call this the square root, quote unquote, of the Klein-Gordon equation. So what Dirac originally, well, in his days, he's very influenced by the Schrödinger equation. The other way he wants to do one-time derivative because it looks more like a Schrödinger equation, which is very successful at the moment. Okay, so I'm not going to bother with this calculation. You don't have to either. The idea is you have a Dirac equation. It has four terms because of the space-time dimension four. So then there's one more term with mass. You just take the term as it's partial t on the left, throw everything on the right. It's not a hard derivation if you want to do it. I'm going to just give you the result. So everybody gets a gamma zero because there is a term called a partial t, gamma zero, but we don't want the gamma zero. We can multiply gamma zero on the other side because this equation tells me that a gamma zero square equals one. Okay, if I take gamma zero, anti-commutator gamma zero, which will give me gamma zero square two. On the other hand, it gave me 2, so gamma 0 squared equals 1. And this clearly where it has come from. It's from the Dirac equation. So we look at the Hamiltonian. Well, Hamiltonian is always useful to look at. But then there is an important property of the Hamiltonian, which is, what's the most important thing being a Hamiltonian? Hermitian. We don't know if they are Hermitian. So this term immediately tells us gamma zero had a better to be Hermitian. And that term will take us a little effort, but I'll put it together. Says what happens to this term after dagger, which is gamma zero dagger, but it's Hermitian, which is gamma I dagger. I'm just doing the dagger from the right to the left. And this dagger, who knows what? But the point is the rest of it, which I identified it as momentum. Momentum is defined to be I times partial derivative. So that thing must be Hermitian because it's a momentum. Okay, now we compare to itself for the Hermitianness. So these things drops off. It tells us gamma I dagger is equals to gamma zero, gamma I, gamma zero. So because gamma zero square is nothing but one, people actually would put it together. So yes, let me now boxes. So you'd think the Dirac equation is just this equation. But no, it needs two more conditions. One tells us about gamma, which is saying that they have this algebra. And the other thing tells us that the Hermitian of the gamma needs to follow this rule. And then you will see that whenever we give you a representation, it's probably gonna be wild. Whenever we give you a wild representation, they always follow this Hermitian rule. Because if you don't, Hamiltonian is not gonna be happy. So that's the first part I want to show you, is how to derive the Dirac equation and the other requirements on the gamma matrices. Okay, so I forgot to mention that Dirac has another criteria, which is actually the most important criteria. What else do we need this equation to do? Which goes back to what we said at the very beginning about this whole lecture. Dirac writes down the equation, has some gammas, they have some properties, but what are we missing? The criteria 1, 2, 3 will allow you to derive Dirac equation. But if it doesn't satisfy the fourth rule, this equation is not good. It's garbage. It's a relativistic field equation, or relativistic quantum mechanics, what Dirac wants to do. So, covariance. We don't know Dirac equation is covariance. So let me show you that it is, but let me show you what we mean by Lorentz in this case. Okay, so it says there is some x prime defined by lambda acting on x. First, I'm going to write down the Dirac equation. So I kind of try to boast that in my interview, you don't have to remember anything. But please remember the Dirac equation. I'm going to see them say it so many times. Just this one. Okay? Okay, so this is a calculation that at least from the little bit, and how the argument works, you want to pay attention. Because it says the Dirac equation is Lorentz covariant and had better be important and will be in the interview. I would ask, why is the Dirac equation Lorentz covariant? So this is a very important proof. So under Lorentz, it says the Dirac field transform at some representation of psi. These are all assumptions. I mean, before you actually solve what it is, it's just a bunch of wishes. We wish Dirac transform nice under a Lorentz transformation. In that case, the new equation should be this. And I made a mistake. Can you tell me where did I make a mistake? That equation has 6. Okay, let's say equals 0 is not the mistake I made. So I either mess up with I, mess up with gamma, mess up with partial derivative, mess up with the sign, mess up with the m. Why is it wrong, what I just write? Under Lorentz transformation, which of those things that I didn't transform should be transformed?
Partial derivative.
The partial derivative. Thank you. That's important. Okay. So what do you mean? What do we mean by Dirac equation is Lorentz covariance? Is that this equation and this equation should look the same? right? The equation, that's really what we mean by Lorentz invariant or covariant, is in the original frame and in the boosted or rotated frame, then those two things should be the same. And how do we do that? What do we do is look at this partial derivative, and I'll do some manipulation that you must be very good at from the relativity course and from Aldo's course. I'm the only person that doesn't have such training in the last few weeks. So I have to copy from the notes. Okay. The first thing off the bat is that I want to turn this derivative into the other derivative. I know they're related by a Lorentz transformation. I'm choosing this one just because I like Lorentz instead of Lorentz inverse. There's no special thing about it. Okay, well, since I'm trying to turn this into this, I'll write psi as the inverse of psi prime. Okay, so now I'm going to copy everything, put everything together, and copy what I achieved so far. Okay, so there are two terms, which means if I fix something with one term, the other term just have to happen. Doesn't have a choice anymore. So I'm claiming this mass term, so simple over here, so simple over here, now have the inverse. So we really have no choice but to add a d lambda so that they will cancel and the mass term is happy while the other term is less so. We seem to be picking up a bunch of terms. And I have messed up some index. Let me correct my index. So this, we'll be staring at this, says, is this true for some Lorentz representation? It must be, because now we're studying this equation instead of putting in a trash can. So the next thing, I'm not going to do it, and you might be doing it for me in the interview. Is that I'm going to do a linear expansion. It's about a 3 lines computation. So you're going to linear expand this, linear expand this. You can say J shows up, and you compare omega, which I know you are very good, because Bruno says you guys all did a great job in homework you submitted. So you are very good at this. So expand, 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 compare omega. And this 3 lines later, you are going to say this. And for this important equation, you don't have to remember. So if you are asked, This, you will be given this. And then, if you mess up with eyes, that's fine. Okay? And but this, you can see where it come from, right? There is a J over here, there's a J over here, and then there's gamma. Sometimes J is in front of gamma, sometimes J is after gamma. It's well, in anyway, you should practice to derive this. You can show me. But I hope you find this equation somehow familiar. Yes? In tutorial 3, it somehow shows up. So you already know the solution of this thing. It says, if you pick this very particular combination, remember? You are thinking about, is it a commutator? How do I make this J? And what kind of coefficient you have? But now you can just say, I've done all that work. This is satisfied by this Lorentz generator I write down. So you find out the Dirac field is a spinner. Dirac field is a spinner, and if it transforms like a spinner, then Dirac equation will be covariant. So this we have already done before. It's in tutorial 3. It asks you why the J filled out with gamma will satisfy the Lorentz algebra. It does. Okay. Let's take a 5-minute break. And we'll come back to even more Lorentz covariant, invariant, all sorts of Lorentzness of the Dirac field.
Why did you write this C of lambda in this?
Uh-huh.
Why did you multiply that C of lambda in?
Oh, so if you look at this term, I wanted to look at like my M.
Yeah, so I choose to.
So if I don't, then the second term wouldn't look right.
When you did the gamma dagger, I wasn't sure how you got the gamma zero in the front.
Oh, okay, sorry. I'm going to put the dagger on.
Yes.
But because the mass term says it's the same, so then you can just use it. It's because of what we get from the mass term.
Yes.
That the gamma zero dagger equals itself.
Yeah, I mean,
and how do we get the gamma I dagger equals the second?
Oh, this one. Okay, so what I have is actually gamma zero, gamma I dagger equals to gamma I, gamma zero.
Yes.
And the idea is that I can multiply both sides with gamma zero and use the fact that the square of this is one.
How do we know that the square?
So we look at the algebra.
Yes.
If you take both mu and the nu to be zero, you will have gamma zero anti-commutator equals 2 eta zero zero, which is 1.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Can I ask, so what are you trying to do with this derivation?
What I'm trying to wish is like, suppose we suppose Psi transformed very nicely under Lorentz. As we struggled all last week, is that this not necessary doesn't necessarily happen. They don't have to be constant. They don't have to be like L, L prime, L prime, L, like that. They don't have to. So then the idea is, at the end of the day, I solved. Says if the generator is given by this, then these two equations would look the same. So I actually managed to find a solution for D of lambda.
If the Dirac field is a spinor,
yeah,
then it transforms like that.
Yeah.
There is a representation of the Lorentz group that is in the spinor.
That's right.
And then, so the first equation implies the second equation.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. That's.
And that statement about the gamma matrices, that's just a statement that the...
Which statement?
Like you write gamma mu equals to D. Like,
this one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a statement that you can treat the gamma matrices like a vector, right?
Well, normally we don't say that because gamma matrices are numbers.
Well, the list of gammas transform because
they can't transform because they're numbers. If you do a Lorentz transformation, your gammas still looks like this 1 1 sigma I.
Yeah,
but these are numbers. This never transform. I understand it does give you that impression. If you sandwich it between, we ate between the Dirac field, this thing actually transform as a vector.
I mean, but then what does this thing say? So if you rearrange a bit,
yeah. It's the other one. I think it's the
okay, yeah.
Right? Which means lambda has to be, it's actually lambda inverse, not the lambda.
Well, that's, yeah.
So if it's, maybe, but the thing is that they are a bunch of numbers. They really can't transform under Lorentz.
Like I know the gamma matrices,
mm-hmm.
like the things inside the gamma are
mm-hmm.
numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
This statement is saying that.
You just fell down a hill until you hit something.
I mean, to me, this statement is saying that you said that the gamma.
I think actually Weinberg has said something about this gamma transform as a vector.
You can treat this, saying that under the spinor representation, you can treat this gamma as a four vector.
And then
this is a four vector.
The need to be
under a Lorentz.
But why? No, but you are saying that you are in some frame.
I'm trying to figure out
what. And you can see the ground frame. And you are saying that
if you go to a
train frame, then gamma will be depend on V.
It doesn't, right?
It does because lambda.
Transformation.
I know.
Yes, so this is confusing.
The correct answer, yes, it doesn't. It's still the same.
Of course, these guys don't change depending on your frame.
Yeah, that's the why that it's. It's hard to call them a vector.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll find out how. Yeah.
So the statement like this, we see this in classical physics.
Yeah, I know.
You look at the rotations.
Yeah.
And then you say you can treat.
You just assume
what you put in. But you just treat. For example, like a momentum operator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you find an equation like this, you basically say the momentum operator is a vector.
But that one does change with
speed. That one does. This one doesn't.
This one doesn't. So it's harder to make the case.
Yeah.
So we're very happy. We find a covariant equation.
Now, Gong?
Yeah.
I have a question about the D matrices that you define.
The D
matrices. That
yeah.
Are they supposed to be finite dimensional or?
Thank you. Very good. So they are supposed to have. They are supposed to be matrix. And very good. So we should start from this point. And you should be like, why? How come gamma just can't be a bunch of numbers? Well, we have the gamma mu, gamma nu, anti commutator equals 2 eta mu nu. As you have seen in relativity, that tells you you have 10 equations. And even there are numbers, there are 4 numbers. And you can try to solve it, it just don't work. So which means they have to be matrices. That's the point I forgot to make, so thank you. So this gamma are actually matrices, and they are kind of the matrices we find in our tutorial 3. You don't have to remember that representation either. Okay, so the next thing I want to pick up is from tutorial 3, we spent a long time looking at the rotations and the boosts. So this, the next topic I want to talk about the reducible wrap, which is the Dirac wrap. But then we want to talk about the irreducible wrap, which is known as the Weyl spin. Okay, so you have seen the rotation matrix, right? It's like 1/2 sigma 3. I'm just going to elevate it and call it the full rotation symmetry. The full rotation matrix looks like this. So there is the familiar exponential, and there is the theta dot sigma in case we have more than one dimension. Okay, there is also the boost you are asked to compute, which looks like this. I didn't do much. I took an exponential and generalize your one-dimensional result to three-dimensional. Okay, that's what I did. So can you tell me what a kind of an interestingly nice property does the rotation matrix and the boost have? Let me recall you, so this sigma is poly, which is 2 by 2, which means this rotational matrix is 4 by 4, and the boost is also 4 by 4. Like what looks so appealing about this two matrix? Why is this matrix more appealing, say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? Which like one, doesn't matter what I write there. The point is it's full, has like components everywhere. So what does this makes you feel? Oh, there must be something nice going on. It's block diagonal, okay, from first week. What does block diagonal tells us? It's reducible. It has subspaces. Very good. Okay. That makes us happy because it's block diagonal. So I must be able to find the irreducible rep that only transform with the top half or the bottom half. So this is the claim, is that we can separate psi into two parts. And then I claim both parts under rotation will pick up the same factor, but under boost, they are a little different. Okay. And I could say that that's what I'm gonna do, and pack up and not worry about anything anymore. But what is so worrisome about doing this? It's not worrisome, but it's just not completely general. It's not like the nicest way to do it. So when we compute this, you are given a well basis. It's not guaranteed at all if you pick another basis for your gamma matrices, they will still separate. But this is not good, because you must be able to separate, because they are two irrep. The ability of separate two irrep away from each other shouldn't depend on the basis we're in. So the next thing we're going to do is look for projection operators. So it's all the good stuff, like P1 plus P2 is 1, and the P1 squared equals P1, and stuff like that. So like keep projecting to this direction. They add up to be 1. Oh, they should be also. Okay. So, what this projection operator should, this is a little, so what, let me describe you a scenario that this projection operator will do no good. So I managed to project my psi into two parts. And now an observer fly by in the plane says, oh, the two parts changes. Like your projection operator changes. It split the parts into two other parts. So that is not good. What I'm saying is I should have the projection operator commute with Lorentz operator. So you can first project and get it boosted, or you can boost it, then project. You will agree with each other. So the well spinners you get should be the same in all the frames. Okay, so this tells us P should either commute with all the gamma, all, or P should be anti-commute with all the gamma. Well, at least that's one way to find out. Because remember, J, the Lorentz generator, is a commutator of gammas. Can you think of an operator actually would commute with all the gamma? Simple. Don't think very crazy, nice operator. That's for the next question. This one, something commutes with like everything. The identity. So you think our operator will have an identity component. The other one is not that easy. And someone tells us the answer. It's called a gamma 5. So there is actually exist a yet another gamma matrices, anti-symmetric with all the gamma matrices you find it before. And interestingly, the reason it's called a gamma 5 or why it anti-commutes is because in the five-dimensional, you can find a 5 gamma matrix, and this is the fifth one. And you can show that a gamma 5 squared to be 1. I might ask you to manipulate the gamma 5 matrices in the interview, especially the fact it anti-commute with gamma mu. You'll be swapping a lot of gamma 5 and gamma mu in the interview. That's a very popular interview question. The significance will shows in Friday's lecture why I love gamma 5 so much. Okay, now we just assemble the two things we have together to make a projection operator. So here it is. Very nicely, you just linear combination of those. You can prove this is a projection operator. And yes, it's possible that I will ask you to prove that's a projection operator in the interview. Well, mostly I'll ask about these properties when you're doing the problem. But I might ask you to do the definition too. And then the next thing is called a sanity check. Sanity check. Now I want to wonder, what is gamma 5 in well? It happened to look like this. And you can calculate the P plus is 1, 0, 0, 0. P minus is 0001. It will do exactly what it said before. It was separated to be a top part and a bottom part. But now we have the tools to actually separate it in any wrap. Well, spinners are extremely important in particle physics. Actually, if you ask a particle physicist, all the fermions are well spinners. So it opens you to this new world of well spinners. Like the thing we know as Dirac electron. Well, that's made with a well, left well electron and a right well electron, but only one participates in the weak interaction, which we'll talk about on Friday. So they are extremely important. So we're going to spend a whole tutorial today on well spinners. Okay? That's why I'm going to move on instead of tell you all sorts of other things about a well spinner. But the selling point of today's tutorial is that there is some, if somebody asks you about the left fermion, you should stop them and ask, which left do you mean? This left or the other left? And you will see why that comes. There are two ways of defining well spinner. They both call it the left-handed, and they don't agree. It's very confusing. And I hopefully you will be less confused by that after the tutorial. Okay, the last topic that I want to discuss to continue the road of between Dirac and Lorenz. So the next last topic of today is Lorenz invariant Lagrangian. You have about 40% of chance will be asked this question. Okay, combined with the Dirac equation's covariance, those two questions you will have 40% of chance getting. Okay, so the proposal, what we propose is learning from the complex scalar, and we say, yeah, Poisson dagger, Poisson probably would work, right? Why wouldn't they? Okay, so this transform as d times Poisson, and this transform as Poisson dagger, d dagger lambda. So far, so good? The question is, can I just say d dagger is d inverse and they annihilate d, so happily ever after? Why and why not? Is d dagger d inverse? You have answer here. Look here. Look here. You can see this is a real representation. So the d dagger would be equals d. It will not give the minus sign we needed to turn it to d inverse. So boosts are not a unitary. Works with the, we don't have some observer called a boost. The point is d dagger and the d is not the same. And I can try to show it to you. Same thing. We find D, and then we'll find D dagger. And the important part is J mu nu is not a Hermitian. The boosts are not a unitary, then the generator regarding boosts is also not Hermitian. Okay, this fun exercise, I'll let you do it. Three lines. And you should be able to do it in the interview room. You take a dagger of it, and you use Poisson mu's dagger, gave you gamma zero Poisson, gamma mu, gamma zero. And what you realize is that you get a gamma zero J mu nu, gamma zero. So there's three line derivation to show you that. And now we can stick this to the d dagger lambda expression, find out that there is some gamma zero j mu gamma zero. And if you do this linear, just do this exponential expansion, you'll realize the gamma zero just came out. And this is one you claim the dagger doesn't equals to D inverse, but it has some gamma zeros. I mean, you can see that when you do this second or third order expansion, there's some gamma zeros in the middle. But because gamma zero square is one, they always cancel. And now, with the new information, we can put this together. Well, doesn't seem to be canceling. See the Psi dagger, and it has some gamma zero, some D inverse, some gamma zero, then there's D and the Psi. So what do we do? How can I make this D inverse and this D unite together and become happily an identity? Put a gamma zero between E. Okay, so we should trace back, put the gamma zero, and hence we introduce this thing called the Dirac conjugate. If you have a bar, it means you are diagered, and then you are given the gamma zero. And you can see, if you want to compute any other Lorentz invariant Lagrangian of Psi, that a gamma zero is always needed. But this is a statement until without a proof. But you can definitely prove it, because on Friday, when we talk about all the interaction Lagrangian for Dirac, they are finite. Not only they are finite, they are in five categories. So if for each category you can prove that a Dirac conjugate is what we needed to make it a Lorentz invariant, and yes, that is also an interview question. To its end, for example, that you can compute what this thing will become now with the shiny Dirac conjugate. Why not? I mean, at this point we have Lagrangian contains Psi bar Psi. What else can we play with except a bunch of gamma matrices? So let's stick some gamma matrices in between them and see if they are still Lorentz invariant. What it tells us is that it becomes this. If this is true, then I can show you this thing is a vector because it transforms like a vector. And then you're like, huh? Seems I have already seen this thing somewhere. When we derive the Dirac equation is a covariant. It's right there. It's the same thing. Maybe I write the D's different positions, but they are the same thing. Okay, to this end, what do we get? We get something Psi bar Psi is good, and the Psi bar gamma mu Psi. Okay, let me ask, What inspired us to get a Psi bar Psi is Psi dagger Psi, which is a phi dagger phi. Which Lagrangian term is that? What does it describe? Kinetic? Mass? Interaction? Phi dagger phi. Which term is that? In your scalar theory, kinetic, mass, or interaction? That when you write a phi dagger phi. So let me try to write it. Don't be too, I'm not sure I got all the factor of half or not half right. But this is the scalar theory, right? Complex scalar theory. So phi dagger phi shows up as a mass. So very good. Now we have Psi bar Psi. Psi dagger Psi, that's out of question.
Go on.
Yeah.
When you land it, mu should be on the right and nu should be on the left, right? It should be like an inverse, like you wrote upstairs.
That's right. Yep. Very good. And I was just arguing with Yale that it doesn't look like that. Then I wrote it wrong. Very good. Okay, so very good. We get a mass term. Okay. We'll postpone that. The next term is that it comes with a Lorentz vector index. It seems a good term for kinetic, right? Because partial nu also comes with a Lorentz index. So I'm going to put those. Okay, at this point, I'm just saying they look like this is going to work. So the claim is this is the Lagrangian density for Dirac field that has the connector and it has the mass term. At this point, you should be suspicious because we used to have m squared phi squared. We are very used to that. How come that there is only m to one power? So this is called dimension analysis, right? Dimension analysis says, what's the mass dimension of the Lagrangian density? Okay, let's backtrack. What's the mass dimension for an action, which you're going to put on the exponential over h bar, but h bar is 1. I hope you got used to the h bar is 1 part. I'm not used to see h bar around anymore, unless the second order expansion is important. Okay, so s, dimension of s is always 0. So what's the dimension of the Lagrangian density? It's integrated over 4.
Minus.
So it must be minus 4. In, okay. Minus 4 in x, in distance. In particle physics, they like to count in mass. But it doesn't matter. Let's say x dimension is minus 4. And Psi, who knows what's Psi's dimension? Psi is Psi. And there is a Psi dagger and a Psi, so 2 of them. Gamma, a bunch of numbers. They don't have dimension. But we have a derivative. Derivative we'll lower the dimension by one because now x shows up on the denominator. Okay, this is minus 4. If you solve it, you'll realize it's minus 3 over 2. And now there's minus 3 here. Together still have to be minus 4, so there's only one mass. So this mass is determined by dimension analysis. Okay, let me just write it again to see why this one, we happily pick this one to be our Lagrangian. All I did is pull out the Poisson bar and the Poisson and put the operator in the middle. I think I lost a 9. I definitely lost a 9. Okay. I lost a 9 in the kinetic term. Well, because I know if I do the derivative with respect to Poisson bar, it will give me the Dirac equation. So now I'm very happy. I have a Dirac free Lagrangian, and it's Lorentz invariant. And the next day we can start to quantize it. But in the last few minutes, I'll write down a formula for you so that you can start the calculation of the second homework. You might find that this thing I wrote down somewhat familiar. I used to spend the time to actually derive these U's and the V's known as the solution. But I realized they are not very important. Actually, if you do any calculation from Dirac theory, what you do is you open this book, find a page called the spinner identities, and then you use the identities, do some calculation. You almost never use the solution itself. Because normally you know the problem that you're working on is probably physical, has some physical meanings. And U and V don't, because they depend on the representation. You solve some U and V in well representation, okay, they look like this. You solve them in some other representation, they look like that. There's nothing physical I can say about them. So that's why, although in the book there is a derivation of the solution. Solution will be the guaranteed part that you are not going to be interested in. Some solution, I mean, somebody solved some solution, it's nice. It's like, oh, I have an equation, and I solve, and I got a solution. It's kind of exciting. But other people will have their solution. They are equivalently exciting. And actually, in a real computation, you will always have. So this is a theme. You can consider it's a theme. Is that a Dirac field always come in pairs. So your solution is always going to meet the other side, then only the spinner identity tells you how to combine U and the two U's and two V's together. So. But if you want to know what the solution look like, it's in the notes. I'm not putting any weight on it. So between this and the Lagrangian here, you should be able to do the second version of the homework. It simply asks you to do the second step of Dan's recipe. Yes, we start with his first step, so we end with his second step. His second step is find the Hamiltonian. So, And next lecture, we'll assume you found the hamster. And then we can play with all this commutator relationship and why we don't have commutator but anti-commutator, all the fun stuff.